think all those ships were doing in a zone that was declared off-limits, commercial traffic, at 8 o'clock that night. They're not, it's not a sea lane.
The boats are heading towards Whiskey 105, which is a military activated warning zone at the day of the crash, meaning it's a possibility of live fire exercises, including the possibility of missiles.
Commercial ships and vessels should stay out.
But I can tell you, I did see a white, what I thought was a flare, going skyward. As we were going in, there were a lot of boats, civilian boats, heading out towards the ocean.
Let me say one other thing. When Dave Hendrick Scott, though, was being the good reporter that he is, he called up both the FBI and the United States Navy asking for comments, and they said they wouldn't comment. So I said, well, I'm going to the FBI specifically said, I'm going to fax this over to you because I want to comment. And Kallstrom's right-hand man, whose name escapes me right now, told him that, in fact, if he faxed it, it would go immediately into the trash can. They weren't going to look at it. They weren't going to comment on it.
James Kallstrom told me on September 10th of last year, Dave recorded the conversation, that three of those ships that were close to the shore were Navy vessels on a classified maneuver.
This is what it showed. The aircraft exploded and went up and down. It went up to, according to the animation, 17,200 feet. But according to the scientists at the NTSB, it could not have climbed higher than 15,100 feet in the simulations. Now, according to the radar data, it didn't climb at all. The radar data indicates that the speed increased immediately following the initiating event.
The 747 had flown since the late 50s, probably hundreds of millions of flights in the United States alone, maybe billions of flights around the world before the center fuel tank of TWA Flight 800 spontaneously exploded, killing all 230 passengers. Now, I enjoy statistics as much as the next person, so I looked at the odds of one flight in just a billion happening. And if you think about how small the possibility of that happening once, then think about all the flights that happened after TWA Flight 800 blew up, and after the FAA made the recommendation of the control for the center fuel valve to shut down the tank before it ran dry, and how many planes did not explode in that time, and then how many planes have not exploded since then, because not all 747s, what, are in U.S. fleets. Not every airline in every country around the world is required to adhere to our standards. Surprise, surprise. There are 747s around the world that still do not have this, quote, fix in place and still haven't magically blown up and fallen out of the sky, killing a couple hundred people. Why is that? From 1996 to 2016, that's another 20 years. That's another billion flights. One would expect, as the fleet gets older, for there to be more problems. But there's never been such a catastrophic explosion again like that. That was the one, the only time, ever. I'm going to go to the New York Daily News. Former Obama pilot, TWA Flight 800, was not blown up by a faulty fuel tank. It was shot down. I've always believed that, and here's why. So this article is from Andrew Danziger, and he's a pilot. He flew the first flight for President Obama when he was inaugurated president and flew him to D.C., and Captain Andy says, was TWA Flight 800 shot out of the sky? As a former pilot, that's a question I get asked about all the time. I'm no conspiracy theorist. And remember, the term conspiracy theory was created by the CIA to combat all the questions about the JFK murder. I'm no conspiracy theorist, but let's be clear. Yes, I say it was. And I believe the FBI covered it up. There are many reasons to disbelieve the official explanation of what happened to TWA 800 almost 19 years ago on July 17, 1996, off the south shore of Long Island. But there's hardly an airline pilot among the hundreds I know who buys the official explanation. I'm going to say that one more time to make sure nobody has any question. This article just came out last year, by the way. There's hardly an airline pilot among the hundreds I know who buys the official explanation that it was a fuel tank explosion offered by the National Transportation Safety Board some 4 years later. Lots can go wrong with an airplane. Engines can fail. They can catch fire. Devices can malfunction. Pilots make errors. But jets do not explode in midair. If they do, it's usually because they've been shot down or bombed. There's little to suggest that there was a bomb on board. But there is ample evidence that a missile of some sort detonated in the air very close to the plane and brought it down. A former colleague, who remained unnamed because he was not authorized to speak publicly about this, served as one of the lead investigators representing the interests of the TWA pilots, and I talked with him at length about the investigation after it was completed. I have also spoken with another former TWA employee who has knowledge of what went on in the aftermath of the crash, how the investigation was conducted, and what my colleague said he witnessed, not to mention the scores of conflicting eyewitnesses and their accounts of the crash, has led me to believe that whatever sent Flight 800 to its fiery demise could not have been a fuel tank explosion. The accident was officially attributed to the explosion of fuel vapors in an empty center tank, probably ignited by a spark from a faulty fuel quality probe inside the tank. The probe wiring is bundled at points with some igniting circuit wires. Investigators determined that there was a crack in the insulation, which allowed high voltage from the igniting circuitry to create a spark that ignited the vapors in the empty tank. I have a problem with this theory, and again, a theory. The probes that measure fuel quantity were recovered from the bottom of the ocean during the salvage effort. They were cleaned, and they all passed stringent tests. There wasn't a single piece of cracked insulation in the 159 miles of wire recovered from the investigation. Conveniently, lengths of wire where the cracks were, quote, imagined to exist, were supposedly among the 16 miles of wire that weren't recovered. I say supposedly for a good reason. According to my colleague who worked for TWA, the mechanics and their representatives were denied access in the early going to the hangar, where all of the recovered material was stored and being reassembled. And there's this. During the investigation, the FBI periodically required everyone to leave the hangar due to national security issues. Only after they sterilized the area were folks allowed in to continue where they had left off, that is, if what they were examining was still there. This happened time and time again, my colleague said. Remember, airplanes just don't blow up in flight. The claim that an empty center fuel tank explodes doesn't pass the sniff test. There are about 45,000 big jet airplane departures every day in the U.S., and most of those planes fly around with empty center fuel tanks, while the main wing tanks, which always start off with fuel, are nearly depleted upon landing. Since the first American jetliner entered into service in 1958, some 38 years before the loss of TWA Flight 800, airlines were flying around with empty or near-empty fuel tanks. Just doing some simple arithmetic, hundreds of millions of flights flew around the U.S. between 1958 and 1996 and never exploded in midair because a combustible mix of fuel vapors triggered an explosion in the center fuel tank. And thinking about this, as we move further along the timeline to the right, as we get older, we supposedly get wiser, we get smarter, we get better. That would mean that sometime in those 38 years, there probably would have been a fuel tank that blew up before this if there was a fault. Does that make sense? You don't go 38 years, then all of a sudden, without changing a process, and then all of a sudden, have something pop up and become a problem. That's not the way manufacturing works, and that's not the way operations work. When you control everything else, it can't just blow up because of this reason that the NTSB and the FBI are sharing with us. Back to the article. Now, that's just what happened in the U.S. If we account for all the flying in the world during that time frame, that would be well north of 1 billion flights in which there wasn't a single in-flight explosion. Now we're talking about tens of billions of flights where there's still no in-flight explosion other than TWA Flight 800, if you believe it. So what actually happened on that horrific day? Here's what we know for sure according to the documents and other reports. TWA was one of the preeminent legacy airliners of its day, with a well-deserved reputation of having some of the highest quality pilots, best-trained mechanics, and well-maintained aircraft. The TWA 800 aircraft was a 747-100 model, built and delivered in 1971. At the time of the accident, the aircraft was 25 years old, by no means a spring chicken, but not old compared to the average fleet age of 747s used at TWA and other major airliners. Airplanes undergo continuous inspections and maintenance as approved by the government regulators and can be kept safe and airworthy for a great many years. You might be shocked to learn the actual age of the airline of the airplane on which you're flying. The Flight 800 aircraft had arrived at JFK a few hours earlier from Athens, Greece. The pilots reported a few minor glitches upon arrival in Athens and their subsequent return to New York, but those mechanical irregularities were all addressed. After some routine servicing, the normal repair work, the aircraft took off for Paris, France, with 230 passengers, including four pilots and 14 flight attendants. Less than 15 minutes after departure, the plane exploded just off Long Island. When it happened, the plane was climbing to about 13,700 feet. That's about right for its location, considering its weight and time from takeoff. It was on a heavily traveled departure path and was trailed by airliners also headed for the Atlantic crossing. Pilots are used to looking for other airplanes in flight. It would be hard for a pilot to misidentify something rising up from the water, climbing almost 14,000 feet into the air, and striking an aircraft that was flying between 10 and 40 miles in front of them. It would be equally difficult to miss something that was just falling out of the sky on fire after exploding in flight for no apparent reason. After the explosion, more than three dozen witnesses reported they'd seen contrails going up into the sky towards the plane. 18 of those people said they saw something come up from the water rising to meet the plane. The FBI only summarized the interviews in its reports. The witnesses weren't permitted to see what was written in the reports, and the NTSB only received summary reports in which all personal information was redacted. And maybe most importantly, the witnesses, there were more than 700 of them, weren't permitted to testify. Among those witnesses were people who attended a wedding on a beach, which was in progress at the time of the explosion. Some of them were recording the ceremony, their cameras trained to the wedding party with the ocean and sky in the background. Many of these people witnessed the explosion. Some say they saw something rising from the water. During the investigation, holes were discovered in parts of the aircraft skin that penetrated from outside in, evidence that an object, most likely a missile, had struck the plane. But when investigators began photographing that evidence, according to my former colleague who was there, the FBI told them to stop. So there's evidence of an explosion from the outside in, as witnessed by investigators, and the FBI told them to stop. I'm sure they weren't allowed to have those pieces back either. Normally, air crash investigations in the United States are led by the NTSB. It's standard procedure to have investigators present who represent all of the interested party. The NTSB, the FAA, the airline, the pilots union, the mechanics and manufacturers of the airplane, the engines and the aircraft components. The FBI's presence at the investigation team was unusual in any fashion, but for the agency to take a lead was unprecedented. The salvage effort and investigation took 4 years, with painstaking study of every recorded piece of evidence, no matter how small. All the recovered pieces were reassembled back into an airplane like a giant jigsaw puzzle. After all that, the FAA issued a recommendation that pilots turn off the center fuel pump before the tank runs completely dry to avoid a similar malfunction. How much sense is this making to everyone so far? Here's a well-respected pilot who's saying that hundreds, not one or two, hundreds of other pilots don't believe an ounce of this report. And yet, it's still touted as the official, this is what happened, making no sense whatsoever to me or to anybody else who looks at the data. If you're just tuning in, this is Greg Carpenter, Reverse Deception Radio on the Veritas Radio Network Crusade. And today we're talking about the downing of TWA Flight 800. This is part two of a two-part series. We're looking at the radar data, we're looking at eyewitness accounts, and we're looking at valid testimony that was never presented and other firsthand accounts of people who know what's going on in this industry and have identified how much of a fraud, I would call it, the NTSB and the FBI reports were. Now, the next thing we're going to talk about is the CIA simulation. which shows what happened when the plane first exploded. In the CIA version, the plane rose to over 17,000 feet with the nose gone and then dove down.
Okay, there must be hundreds and hundreds of people in the Air Force, the Army, the Navy that know that that CIA video was nonsense.
That's a true statement. And anybody with any common sense at all can also see that that CIA video was complete nonsense.
The CIA fraudulent video. And I'm going to use words. I'm going to say what I believe. What Tom presented here is an excellent piece of evidence that would stand up in a courtroom. For somebody to put together a multi-thousand dollar media extravaganza and feed it to the U.S. media the way that was done, at one of the biggest press conferences the FBI ever held, is scurrilous.
So what have we to say about that? Essentially, it's embarrassing what the CIA passed off as an honest evaluation of what happened in light of what the data shows. There's no way that plane climbed from 13,700 feet to over 17,000 feet with the nose taken off. I beg for anyone to put a simulation in place where the plane is traveling at the rate identified by the radar data and then have it fly with no nose and climb while picking up speed, and climb in such a short amount of time that it's climbed over 3,000 feet and then dives off into the water. The math doesn't work, the physics don't work, and this is not rocket surgery. This is very straightforward stuff.
This is what it showed. The aircraft exploded and went up and down. It went up to, according to the animation, 17,200 feet. But according to the scientists at the NTSB, it could not have climbed higher than 15,100 feet in the simulations. Now, according to the radar data, it didn't climb at all. The radar data indicates that the speed increased immediately following the initiating event.
So the NTSB says it climbed to 15,100 feet. The CIA says it climbed to over 17,000 feet. And the actual data says it started picking up speed immediately, which means that there was nothing else that could have happened other than it started to descend, and it descended very rapidly. That's the real answer. That can be the only thing that answers this question. Now listen closely to the input of a 4-star admiral and his perspective on what really happened that day.
Find the person that drew the diagram to show that airplane climbing after it was hit, or after it lost its engines, lost its nose, climbing 2,000 feet. And then go find any swept-wing jet pilot, of which Commander Donaldson is one, and I'm one, and all of us said that is absolutely, and Captain Mundell over here, that's absolutely impossible.
No words being minced here, are there? It is absolutely impossible for that plane to increase altitude without engines and with no nose. If you can't think of it in those terms, then you're pretty much going to drink the Kool-Aid that you've been given in the original reports. Now we're going to look at the actual impact and what happened afterwards. Say for all intensive purposes that a missile did hit the plane. Well, that would cause some type of reaction, right? For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. If an inboard tank blows up, how much velocity is going to be behind something like that? It's not a high velocity event for metal, is it? No. But if something is flying into the plane at Mach 2, Mach 3, then something theoretically will come flying away from the plane at Mach 2 or Mach 3. Right? Listen to this.
At least one wreckage item exited the plane at a speed in excess of Mach 2. That's these two hits here. And they're two hits. So it's less likely to be an anomaly. And, of course, it is an anomaly in the official theory.
At least two items were identified leaving the plane at Mach 2. That makes it not a coincidence. That makes it factual. They only found two, but there could have been more. There could have been a lot more. But because the FBI was hoarding information, hoarding parts, hoarding data, nobody was really able to put those things together. Now, were they? You have heard that. Now, think about this.
The people sitting right above that tank should be burned in certain ways. Some of them weren't burned at all.
The people who were sitting right above the center tank were not burned at all. Let's think about it for a second. Could there have been a fire above the center tank if no one was burned above the center tank? That was not the tank that caught on fire, was it? The NTSB and the FBI said it started with a piece of wire that was exposed. It caused a spark in the center tank. So the center tank should have been the first thing that had flames, and it should have combusted and consumed the people above it, and it did not. Now remember, we have a plane that is not climbing because the radar data shows it.
So if you plot both, that was just, I think that was east-west position versus time. You can also do the same analysis on north-south position versus time, differentiate and get speeds versus time, and when you do that, you get this plot. This is what the radar data shows. The radar data shows plus or minus a couple, maybe 50 knots or so, that the plane increased speed to approximately 460 knots, if I can remember correctly, right after, in the first few seconds of flight. The simulation shows it decreasing immediately. Now, why would they show it decreasing? Well, remember, the animation showed the plane climbing. So the only way to do that, to climb that sharply, would have had to decrease ground speed. But the radar data shows the ground speed increased. So the conclusion one could make was that the plane did not climb.
We have a plane immediately picking up speed upon explosion, an explosion that burned no one where it initially exploded at. Got that? Unreal. You're listening to Reverse Deception Radio here on the Veritas Radio Network Crusade. We're coming to the end of the segment. We're going to pick it up in segment two, right where we left off here. Into the break, one word, Grossberger. If you don't know it, look it up.
Down in the valley, the valley so low, hang your head over, hear the wind blow, hear the wind blow, love, hear the wind blow, hang your head.
Reverse Deception. We'll be right back on the Veritas Radio Networks Crusade.